Hi, everyone. I'm Anita Lustria, and for many years I did live radio. Then I transitioned to the podcast world where I feel I found my home. I love talking about spiritual formation, justice issues, and spiritual practices. Throw in the Enneagram, movies, and current events from time to time, and that's what you get on the podcast. I'm glad you've come along for the ride. Welcome to Faith Conversations. Welcome to Faith Conversations, everyone. I am delighted today to welcome to the broadcast Christian Cobus-Dume. She is a professor of history at Calvin University and the author of A New Gospel for Women. You may have read her in the Christian Century, Christianity Today, Washington Post. You probably have seen her work in those places, but you may also have read Jesus and John Wayne, her most recent book, subtitled How White Evangelicals Corrupted a Faith and Fractured a Nation. All right. I know your ears just picked up on that, right? Perked up. So let me first say welcome, Kristen. And did I get your name right?
You did. Perfect. Kristen Cobus-Dume. It's a tough one.
All right. Very good. So glad to have you on. And I'm just thinking about this book. I listen to it as an audiobook. I ride my bike. I'm in Florida, and all during COVID, I've been able to get out and ride my bike, and I've been listening to audiobooks. Enter Jesus and John Wayne. I would be listening to this book. I would come back into the house and find myself really irritable, which is not like me at all. And I found myself being kind of snippy with my husband, again, not even remotely like who I am. And I finally traced it back to your book. So I've gotten you on here to yell at you. No, not really. So Jesus, John Wayne, I mean, the subtitle alone, I mean, this is a book that basically exposes the way, and I think these might be your words, I got this from Twitter, exposes the way power is wielded within white evangelicalism in defense of white Christian patriarchy, and I'll add to that, and white supremacy.
They're inseparable. White Christian patriarchy and white supremacy go hand in hand.
So this is the system that I grew up in. A system that I have, since about 2007, been slowly distancing myself from. And then you enter 2016, that election, and somewhere in the middle of that space, my husband and I talked a lot about that term, evangelicalism, right? Mm-hmm. Could we even call ourselves evangelicals anymore? And really, the bottom line is no. Not with what it is associated with today. So I've been talking a lot. I want to get to the first question here. Your first book, I believe it was your first book, A New Gospel for Women, and Catherine Bushnell and the Challenge of Christian Feminism. That was 2015. As you thought about what was next for you, how did you come to this specific topic?
Very indirectly. This was not the next book I set out to write. Actually, I'd written A New Gospel for Women, and it's a story of this remarkable evangelical feminist in the late 19th, early 20th century. She was a Methodist woman, social reformer. She was an anti-trafficking activist and came to understand how patriarchal Christian theology actually set men up to abuse women and communities up to be unable to condemn that abuse. So then she retranslated the scriptures because she was a fundamentalist. She was absolutely upheld the authority of the scriptures and realized that a lot of passages that were about women were mistranslated. They were just false. And so she came up with corrections, and that was an incredible story. So
why have I never heard of her? I mean,
exactly. The it's completely like she, in the book, I talk about how in some ways she ended up being too Christian for feminists and too feminist for Christians. And so that was a work of recovery. It was what happens if we bring this story into, you know, 20th century American religious history. But her work really profoundly shaped me because she was a biblical inerrantist who said, properly translated and interpreted, the words of God does not establish patriarchy. Patriarchy is instead the corruption of God's will for women and men. So that was a starting point. From there, so she was a progressive Methodist woman, and a conservative theologically, progressive socially. And then from there, I ended up picking up the topic of exploring the faith formation of Hillary Clinton, another progressive Methodist woman. And deeply Christian, but in a progressive way that was very much aligned with this longer history of Methodist women. And one thing led to another. She declared for president, and suddenly I was in the thick of writing on religion and politics in the 2016 campaign season, and keeping a very close eye on white evangelicals, but kind of from this other vantage point, right? And watching already in 2015, early in this process, at the grassroots, watching evangelicals falling behind Donald Trump, support him. And so I was observing this with great interest. And then it was in the fall of 2016, in the days after the Access Hollywood tapes released, that by that time, it was clear that white evangelicals were going to continue to support Trump despite everything, and at, pretty overwhelming levels of support. And at that point, all of a sudden something dawned on me, because 15 years earlier, I had started and then eventually abandoned a little research project on white evangelical masculinity and militarism. And I set this project aside back in 2006 because other things were coming along and I had other things to do, and I wrote my first book. I meant to get back to it. But in ensuing years, I didn't stop paying attention to many of the men who were the main proponents of this militant Christian manhood. What I saw is one after another became embroiled in scandal, in abusive power or sexual abuse. And so I just kept tabs on that. And so in the wake of Access Hollywood, it just clicked for me. Like, we've seen this before. We've seen this so many times before when evangelicals embrace and defend an abusive leader because he is a strong man. He's their ultimate fighting champion. He will protect them. He will, the ends will justify the means. And so at that point, I dusted off this old research and thought, after the election results came in, I thought, well, I'm going to table this Clinton book for a little bit. The dust needs to settle on that one. But I have this other project, and I really wanted to put these pieces together.
Wow. And am I glad you did. I can just say that.
It was the right time.
It was absolutely the right time. I have to say that initially I read The Preacher's Wife, which Kate Bowler put out into the world about evangelical women and their place, not being pastors. I've lost the subtitle here in my notes, but I know others are aware of The Preacher's Wife. And somebody, a friend of mine, said, okay, when you finish that, you have to read Jesus and John Wayne. Yeah. And so I read Bowler's book with some interest and amusement. I was a white evangelical woman who mm-hmm. hosted a radio talk show on a largely white evangelical network. Mm-hmm. And so it was a little bit more of a trip down memory lane, though there were certainly things that gave me plenty of pause as I listened to the audiobook of Bowler's. What is that subtitle? Do you know it?
Yes, just grabbed it off my shelf. The Precarious Power of Evangelical Women Celebrities.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. Yeah. And but I had no idea what was going to happen inside my heart when I started listening to Jesus and John Wayne. Different experience, how much I identified with it, also how much I realized I didn't know as you went back in history, because I think I was certainly aware that we didn't get to this spot of white Christian nationalism with the 2016 election. I knew that, you know, this was building, but I don't think I knew how long this had been building. And so I highly encourage people to grab a copy and read Jesus and John Wayne. But for those that are just hearing the title of the book for the first time, take us back in history. I mean, how far back did this really get its beginnings? It's scary.
Yeah. You know, you can go way back and find some of the roots of this. You can go back to the 19th century. You can go back to particularly 19th century Southern evangelicalism. Then you can find manifestations in the early 20th century in terms of muscular Christianity, in terms of Christian militarism in the context of the First World War. But you also have a lot of differences when you go back. You can find alternate, you know, visions of masculinity in 19th century America, where, you know, to be a Christian man was to exhibit gentlemanly restraint. In the First World War, you can find conservative Protestants who resisted militarism, who resisted Christian nationalism, because they believe that, you know, to be a Christian is to have your soul saved, and a nation doesn't have a soul. And so they were much more separatist. And, you know, so there's a mix. You can find precursors, but you also find a lot of differences, which is important, because things have not always been the way they are now. And that's part of what I try to do in the early chapters of this book, to say this came from somewhere. It was pieced together. And it's really in the 1940s when we see these pieces start to fall into place. First, in the context of World War II, the rise of the National Association of Evangelicals, 1942, Billy Graham's role in that. And then by the end of the 40s, the early Cold War really solidifies these pieces, where we see Christian nationalism, this defense of Christian America, in the case of the Cold War against communism. And communists were, you know, anti-God, anti-family, and anti-American. So all of the things that evangelicals held dear, that were close to their identity, the center of their identity. And that they needed to be, and therefore America, Christian America, needed to be defended. And the threat was military, so a militant defense. And you see this come together and link together with gender traditionalism, with this emphasis on gender difference, on the opposite nature of men and women. So somebody like James Dobson will say men and women are different in every cell of their bodies. Okay, so technically there's some biological truth to that, but then extrapolated, what does that mean? It really sets up, you know, gender roles as opposites. So men are strong, men are courageous, men lead, men are aggressive. Women are the opposite of all of that, need to be defended, protected. They are submissive, they are sweet, they are so feminine, and a lot goes into that, you know, that description. And so this is that combination of Christian nationalism, of masculine protector, and gender traditionalism really moves to the center of evangelical conceptions of orthodoxy. Like, this is what it means to be Christian. And that's really the story that I trace then throughout the next half century and up to the present.
I think the way it played out in my life within a conservative Christian organization was that piece, especially that patriarchal piece, that gender difference piece. You know, I remember a boss that called me and my co-host, you know, how are you doing today, little ladies?
Yes.
You know, walk up behind us, like, touch or do a back rub. And I'm like, don't touch me. I didn't know. And we're not little ladies, we're women. And, you know, and some of these things started to register with me, I think. And the realization that while we men and women were different, as you were just talking about, that there are these differences, I went the direction of there are these soul differences. I moved into the realm of spiritual formation and realized that I had a feminine soul that had not been spoken to maybe my entire life. And yet then I eventually realized, well, there's a spiritual formation piece that is larger than just my feminine soul. Men and women both mm-hmm. has not been spoken in that realm of evangelicalism in the evangelical church. Mm-hmm. And I see that the big divide even as being more spiritual formation and justice over on one side, and this other over on the other side, the Christian patriarchy, white supremacy that are intertwined, and you know, and that's kind of how it played out in my world as I started thinking about it and realizing I need to separate myself here. Mm-hmm. But I didn't have words for this. And then Jesus and John Wayne comes along, right? Yeah. Any thoughts about that? I mean, do you see that difference too, that split along those lines?
Even more fundamentally, I think I perceived a split in the nature of Christian virtue, right, in this research. So, take the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, self-control. All of these things are coded feminine within this ideology, right? So these are great for the ladies, but these are not what God calls men to do and to be in this moment, because the threat is so great, and the threat changes, right? It's communism, and then it's secular humanism, and it's feminism, and it's liberalism, and it's radical Islam, and it's the Democratic Party, right? There's always the threat. Now it's social justice warriors. And, because of this perceived threat, men should not be exhibiting these. Men should not be turning the other cheek. They literally throw that out. Like, that doesn't apply to this situation. Love your neighbor, love your enemy, that stuff. No. Right now, you know, our Jesus is a warrior Christ, and we are to follow that warrior Christ into battle. Again, the battles of their own choosing. And so I think that's what has, that's part of the corrupted the faith part that I'm talking about, right?
Well, I'm sitting here going, where's the proof text for that? Because there's proof texting for all kinds of other things. I've grown up with that. So where is the proof texting for this brand?
Well, the Book of Revelation is where they'll turn, right? So there's bloody battles there, and there's, you know, this apocalyptic imagery. And so that's where they're, you know, the Book of Revelation is more important than the Gospels, certainly in terms of, you know, holding up a Christ that they want to then follow and pattern their lives after. So there will be, biblical verses thrown in here and there, but it's not centered on the gospel.
Well, and of course, the Book of Revelation, I mean, new interpretations started elevating in the 50s, maybe, mm-hmm. But nothing's really said about that.
Right. No. So, you know, very select understandings. It's basically the bloody warrior part. That's what's celebrated there. But I mean, your response too, I think, really does connect to what I'm hearing from so many readers, which is, I am so intimately familiar with this, and yet I had no idea, right? I had no idea how all these pieces fit together. And that's been the overwhelming response. So, you know, since the book has come out last summer, I've received several hundred letters from evangelicals, and almost all of them say some version of that. Like, this is the story of my life. Yeah. And then they go ahead and they tell me that story, like that lines chapter by chapter. So then I read this book, and then I went to that conference, and then I was a part of this, and then I got married, and this is what we struggled with in our marriage, because we were trying to make it fit into this. And I mean, like, really, like, page after page. And then they say, and yet I had no idea. And that's something that I've been sitting with, actually, as a scholar. You know, how can both be true? Because they are both true. And I think part of the explanation is that evangelicals have really controlled their own stories, right? They have told their own stories. They have told sanitized stories of who they are and who they have been.
And they have not encouraged any kind of independent thinking.
Exactly.
I've talked multiple times here on the podcast that I didn't even learn how to think critically until I was about 40. I kind of began the journey at 40 which, you know, in one sense, it was so distressing to me. But in the other sense is, well, at least you began at 40.
It's a journey.
It is a journey. Yeah. And, but that recognition that I was really told, this is what you believe and you don't question.
And that I
was in lockstep with that until I wasn't.
Yes. And then that can be a really rough transition. It can, a lot of people are kind of walking that part of their journey right now of coming to terms with the fact that, you know, their faith it does not actually align with many of the values of their faith community at this point. And that can be a very painful process, but also a very cathartic process. And again, I'm hearing from so many people who are in the midst of that right now. And, but there are so many stories of hope, right? And that people are finding each other on the other side of this. And deconstruction is a popular word right now. And what I'm hearing is, you know, people who are deconstructing, but not deconstructing their faith in its entirety, just deconstructing what cultural baggage has been attached to the Christianity that they still hold to, and trying to separate this baggage apart, and then cling even more firmly and with more faith and more conviction to biblical Christianity.
I agree. I mean, I see that happening. I will go sometimes to the Richard Rohr language of order, disorder, reorder. And though I certainly use that deconstruction, reconstruction language as well. So I'm a spiritual director. That's my main job. And I see it so much in clients that come to spiritual direction because all of a sudden they are going through some kind of a faith shift. And I hear that through emails to the podcast too, the various people that I choose to have on. And, you know, that is the underlying theme through which people tend to come and intersect with me and my life. And so I'm very curious to hear, yes, you've gotten a huge amount, hundreds of emails saying, oh my goodness, yes, you're telling the story of my life. But what about those emails on the other side? Or are you even being read by other people?
Yeah, I don't want to jinx things, but at this point, I'm getting very little negative feedback. Very, very shockingly, when this book released, I was warned by my publisher's lawyer to brace myself and prepare for vicious trolling, and so that really hasn't happened. Which isn't to say everybody loves the book. You can go to Twitter and you can find some critics. Sometimes they tag me. Sometimes I respond. Sometimes I let it go. And you know, you can find some reviews where people are really pushing back. But again, this is the definite minority at this point to an astounding degree. And you know what critics are saying. Some will say I paint with too broad a brush stroke. And so wanting to say, yes, there's some bad stuff here, but the kind of not all evangelicals thing, or saying, you know, you just focused on the extreme examples to try to, you know, kind of build your narrative. And to that, I would say, you know, this is actually something that I think aloud about in the book itself, right? You know, what is the mainstream and what is the fringe? And I will say that my understanding of what was fringe and what was mainstream shifted as I researched and wrote this book.
Say more about that. Well, as I'm even hearing you say this, I'm thinking, wait, too broad a brush stroke. This is the fringe. Well, wait a minute. 81%.
Right.
That's what I'm thinking of about the 2016 election.
And even after, you know, after 2016, even after the book has come out, I will say that the book is holding up extraordinarily well and alarmingly well in light of recent events. But no, I mean, this is something that I really did wrestle with. You know, when I first, well, that was one of the reasons I set the research aside all those years ago, because what I was finding was incredibly disturbing. You know, so I read John Eldredge, and then I was watching what was going on at Mars Hill Church with Mark Driscoll, and I was reading some of these sermons, and I was watching videos, and I thought, this certainly feels extremist. It was deeply misogynistic and, you know, and very disturbing. And so that was one of the questions, like, is this just the, you know, the darkest underbelly of America? American evangelicalism? And do I need to shine this bright light on it? And as a Christian myself, is that the right thing to be doing? That was one of the reasons I set the project aside. And then when I pulled it back out again, you know, I was a little bit more convicted that no, this is more mainstream than I thought. And then even as I wrote the book, I initially did not plan, for example, to include Bill Gothard in this book because I thought, nope, he's fringe. He's very fringe. And I didn't want to discredit the narrative. And so many people I talked to, like mainstream evangelicals, you know, friends of mine, colleagues, they're like, you are going to include Bill Gothard, aren't you? And then they would tell me their stories. And so then I thought, I need to look into this. And the more I looked into it, the more I realized, yes, just beneath the surface, but deeply influential. And then what I end up doing in the book is holding, you know, in one chapter, I talk about Bill Gothard, and then I talk about James Dobson. James Dobson, you know, undeniably mainstream. Bill Gothard, yes, let's call him fringe. But let's look at what they have in common here. And they are saying remarkably similar things about authority, the nature of authority and submission, the gendered hierarchies and the broader social hierarchies. And so that's really the motif that I bring through the book. You know, take somebody who is arguably or indisputably, quote unquote, fringe, and then bring them into conversation with mainstream. And then sometimes they bring themselves into conversation. So later in the book, I talk about somebody like Doug Wilson, absolutely fringe. Yes, right. He would be offended, deeply offended, if you called him mainstream evangelical. And yet he is being platformed by Christianity Today. He's being defended by John Piper. Right?
Tell who he is for people that don't know who Doug Wilson is.
Oh, Doug Wilson. I hate to be the one to introduce anyone to Doug Wilson. Right. He has a kind of mini empire out in Moscow, Idaho. And he's a very cantankerous figure coming out of, he's influenced by Christian Reconstructionism a bit, and then Reformed thinking. He never really fit in any established denomination because he is so cantankerous. So he starts his own, school, and he starts his own college. And again, fringe. He has his own publishing house, and he publishes just very, you know, conservative views on gender and, you know, women's submission and this kind of militant, rugged masculinity. Like, he just churns these things out and has a blog and so on. So anyway, you know, a fringe character, but one who has a really loyal and has long had a very loyal following in Reformed denominations, and has really shaped, you know, a lot of young men that I ended up talking to, a lot of pastors, where they're like, yeah, you know, he's a little extreme, but, and then embrace a lot of his teachings. He also has written some very racist books on, you know, condoning slavery. Slavery was a good thing, and that's part of what I highlight. So in the book, I try to look at, you know, where are the lines drawn? Where are the boundaries drawn within evangelicalism as a movement? So what kind of things can you say to get yourself kicked out? So you start talking about, especially, you know, in conservative evangelicalism, you talk about women's equality, or, you know, see ya, you know, you're not one of us anymore. Certainly LGBTQ issues, right? Done. Yeah. And so the, you know, distribution networks, the platforming, all of that, like, closed off to you, publishing houses and so on. But take somebody like Doug Wilson, who can say really extreme things, deeply troubling things on sexuality, sexual violence, you know, deeply misogynistic things, very racist things. And he still gets counted as a brother in Christ and, you know, a pat on the back and platformed. And so that's something that I tried to make visible in this book. So yes, some folks are fringe, some are mainstream. What are the connections, the affinities, the alliances? Where are the boundaries drawn and who gets to draw them? And then by the end of the narrative, you know, what I'm seeing is that, you know, what was once fringe, or what we once perceived to be fringe, is actually closer to the mainstream than many of us ever imagined. And what we imagine to be mainstream is actually rather marginalized right now within the broader evangelical movement.
What do you see? I mean, we talk about and see the great divide.
Yeah.
How do you see this playing out moving into the future?
Oh, right now, I think a lot of individuals are awakening to the reality of this divide. It was patched over for a long time. It's not new. But, you know, the language that we would use and the calls for unity and, just practices of being nice and not being disruptive. And again, interest in the mission of the church and instincts to protect the witness, instincts that I shared, right? I had set this project aside thinking, is this really what a Christian should be doing? Do I need to expose this dirty laundry to the world? You know, is that the right thing? So I was a part of this. And it seemed like a very noble instinct at the time. I think that has papered over. All of those practices have papered over these deep differences for a long time. Individually, I think that people are awakening to the fact that these are profound differences, so profound that we might actually be talking about different faiths in the end, certainly dramatically different versions of the Christian faith. So where does that leave us right now? A lot of individuals are beginning to speak out and encountering a lot of pushback when they do. Many are quietly leaving churches, organizations. Many are getting pushed out of churches, organizations, pushed out of jobs. Mm-hmm. That's something you can speak to as well. Right. But what I see happening at this point, you know, there's all this talk of an evangelical reckoning. What I see is the institutions are holding steady at this point, maintaining the status quo that, you know, people are leaving or getting pushed out. That actually leaves those behind who are more unified and often more reactionary. And so while I'm hopeful for the change I'm seeing and the courage I'm seeing on an individual level, the power dynamics are such that many institutions are not really embarking on courageous change in this moment.
I talked not too many podcasts ago to Brian McLaren, and we certainly talked about this. Yeah. I just talked with, I think, podcast before last with Jamar Tisby, and we didn't get into this as much, but right after I released that podcast, he came out with a tremendous podcast on his
leaving
own.
Loud.
Leaving Loud. And I love that term.
Yes.
You know, I was very much leaving soft and I was talked to about, leaving well, and I was kind of, what's the word? I was, not incensed at all. I was hurt that they would think I would consider not leaving well.
Yes.
Of course, that's what you do as a Christian.
That's what you do.
I never thought of leaving loud, but they were concerned I might leave loud.
Yes.
Well, and so since then, you know, I'm thinking about all this and hearing and that term, I'm like, wow, this is a time where leaving loud is needed. And of course he, in a way, left his denomination, not super loudly, because that's now been a little bit of time has passed, maybe a couple of years. I have to look back at that. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even know that he had.
Yes.
So, you know, that is shifting. George Floyd, the murder of George Floyd, I think has, is a big factor in this conversation. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. You know, I think the timeline is different for different people. You know, many people over the last 20, 30 years have been leaving quietly, respectfully, you know, not wanting to disrupt the mission of the organization or the church. And then in the African-American community, you know, pre-George Floyd, but especially, you know, post-George Floyd. So the New York Times in 2018 had a story on the quiet exodus of Black Christians from white evangelical spaces. So, you know, the timeline varies, but I think leaving loud is incredibly important because so much of the stories that I relate in Jesus and John Wayne, are stories of truth being covered up, of truth being suppressed, of, and all in the name again of unity or of, you know, of deference. So much misplaced deference. Deference is required, right? You submit to your authorities. You respect those that God has placed in charge of you. I was not prepared when I was reading the primary sources for this book, just how much authority was a theme. You submit to your authorities. And now, who are these authorities who are telling you to submit to those authorities? You know, they're powerful white men. Yeah. And they're telling you, you better keep submitting to us or you are disobeying God.
And it's right? funny because none of them stood up and said, largely, I'm saying none, look at the model of Jesus. Look how he continually, I lead a Lexio Divina group. Every Wednesday morning. And I've been hanging in the Gospels as during Lent. Well, how many of, as I'm reading different passages to pull out and use for Lexio, how many of those passages, and again, Jesus said to the Pharisees, or again, Jesus, you know, on the Sabbath did such and such.
So disruptive. Disruptive, right, to the status quo, and disruptive to, understandings of power. I mean, his entire life and ministry and death, all of it went against human conceptions of power and seizing power and grasping it and maintaining it. That's not who Jesus was. That's not the right. We are to take up our cross and follow Christ. And so that was actually a very intentional choice in this book. As I saw through my research, these patterns of deference, I saw how that was demanded and discipled in people. I decided at some point, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to write a book that refuses to show deference to these leaders, to these abusers of power. And so that explains the title, that explains the chapter titles, that explains the tone of the book. And I think that's why it's such a different history than evangelicals have ever read before, even as it is the story of their lives.
Oh my goodness. So true. And I have to say, you're in Grand Rapids,
yes,
which is kind of a little Jerusalem. I'm in Sarasota, Florida now, but I spent 32 years in Chicago. I have said this out loud, maybe not on this podcast, but I'll say it now. When I moved from that evangelical bubble, you know, Moody Bible Institute,
yes,
College, Trinity College, both Trinity College South, Trinity International University North. Uh-huh. And, you know, you go on, you can layer this Christianity Today publication, mm-hmm, all these publishers. Now you've got all this stuff going on.
We've got it in Grand Rapids too.
When I made the move, it was like something fell off my back. I didn't even realize it, that getting geographically away from that space was a part of my healing. I felt myself, like my spine, you know, becoming more firm and solid and straight. I found myself blossoming in ways that were kind of shocking, just from a geographical change. That kind of shocked me.
I believe it. Yeah. And I am in the thick of it. You're right. I'm in Grand Rapids and I, you know, kind of a center of evangelical publishing, one of the centers. I'm at a Christian university that, you know, is, has buildings named after the DeVosses and the Prince family. So that's right, where I find myself.
Exactly. So let's talk for a minute about generations. So I'm a boomer.
Uh-huh.
I'm 60, boomer. You are what generation?
Gen X.
Gen X. Yep. So my son, who's 28, is a millennial.
Mm-hmm.
So what I found so fascinating is how much harder this journey for me has been, this journey out of patriarchy and all this for me has been. And for my son, the millennial, we have kind of been on very similar, you know, order, disorder, reorder paths, but with 30 years between us, say, you know, and it's been wonderful conversationally, and maybe he came to it more easily. I don't know. He's a historian as well. He's a Civil War scholar and works in that field, and is very interested in all of this. I've been banging the drum for him to read Jesus and John Wayne, just because I want him to. Selfishly, I want you to know my history, John.
You know? Exactly.
I want you to know the crap that I came out of, or that I walked through, or that I adhered to for so long and can still, you know, find myself struggling to move beyond at times, you know. So this is so interesting. So generationally, but I can't, you can't even put that, I can't put that on the millennials, because you've got the millennial children of the 81%, though, that are still lining up there.
Yeah, so you got to be careful. So
what do you say about the generations there?
Yeah, you know, there's always the there has long been the narrative of, you know, the decline of evangelicalism. Just look at the younger generation. And yet, here we are, right? I've been hearing this for decades now. And so, you know, you can see some real survey data that points to, you know, young evangelicals today are much less likely to embrace right-wing politics. They are going to have more progressive views on things like immigration and LGBTQ rights, pretty similar with views on abortion as they are with their parents. And so, you know, you can get into the data and you can find different patterns there, but then you kind of step back and you know, one lesson is that young evangelicals become older evangelicals. And you also have, again, this kind of exit strategy where you have those who are, who don't agree with the politics or, you know, politics or some aspects of, you know, conservative evangelicalism that either get pushed out or walk away and say, this isn't for me. And maybe they walk away from the faith entirely or just find a different, you know, church home. And so who remains? And I think that's a pattern that we just continue to see. And that's why evangelicalism itself has not really, you know, transformed, even as many people have or have left. But the generational thing is, yeah, always a big grain of salt when you hear projections about the future of evangelicalism based on the most recent survey.
Wow. I just looked at my notes and a name leapt off the page that I had not mentioned yet that is in your book that I felt for so long was kind of off limits, or certainly he's not in the middle of all this. You know exactly who I'm going to say.
Yes.
Billy Graham.
Billy Graham. Yeah.
I'm so glad I saw his name. I need to talk to you about Billy Graham. I mean, I think my chin is still on the floor. I've been collecting dust in my mouth for weeks.
Yeah. You know, this is so funny because I grew up kind of on the edges of evangelicalism. I grew up in the Christian Reformed Church in a Dutch immigrant community. My mom was an immigrant, you know, so, but I listened to Christian radio, Christian music, all of that. And, you know, had a Christian bookstore in town, the only bookstore. So I'm in this culture, but not at the center of it. And so my tradition always defined itself, you know, Dutch Reformed as kind of over against American evangelicalism. So I didn't grow up with this idealization of Billy Graham. He was always kept a little bit at arm's length. Like, yeah, he's doing some good work there, but he's not one of us. And so I was not fully prepared for the response to this book around Billy Graham, the shock at this is not who we thought Billy Graham was. And on the one hand, you know, I intentionally disrupted some notions. So there's a great picture of Graham in the book, right? And I love that picture because so many people, when you think of Graham today, you think of him in his later years,
right?
Older, you know, dignified and less political, but you have to know his history. First of all, he used to be this dashingly handsome man with a square jawline and like every news reporter had to mention this like for decades.
Right.
And, you know, he was very aware of his masculinity and he cultivated that. That was part of his shtick. That was part of his gospel witness, his evangelism, right? And he was deeply and enormously political and ambitious. And he was incredibly, you know, he was supportive of US militarism, extremely so.
So, you know, if we know this history and read this history in your book, it should be no shock to look at his son, Franklin, today.
Exactly. Exactly. You
know, I think that's part of what it opened up to me, but.
You know, now he did step back later in life and he had learned some lessons, but unfortunately those were not, he was not able to convey those lessons very powerfully to his own son or to many other evangelicals.
No, I don't think he chose to. I think he did it a lot more quietly I wish he'd been a lot more loud about that.
Exactly. Exactly. And so this is, you know, it's really the reaction to Graham that again makes me think, you know, what stories have evangelicals been telling themselves? And I saw that when he died, you know, a couple of years ago, and, you know, is important figure in American religious history and American history more broadly. So there are a lot of, you know, kind of reflections on his legacy after his passing. And I saw responses to those, you know, most of them were just effusive. And then there were a couple of historians that brought a more, you know, critical analysis along the lines of this book and this book I'd just been wrapping up at the time. And I read those and thought, yep, right on. And then I saw the response to them in the Christian community and even among Christian scholars, even among progressive Christian scholars who, you know, were basically saying, how dare you? How could you? This is dancing on his grave. And I remember being shocked at the time, like, you know, what are you talking about? This is, we have evidence. This is history. This is his legacy. And we have to hold this together with his evangelistic legacy, because this is what he was evangelizing. And so, you know, this question of who gets to tell Billy Graham's story and what are we allowed to say? I didn't know I was breaking rules here. I had other people say, like, you are so courageous because you named names in this book. And I step back and I say, I'm a historian. I don't know how to write history if you don't name names. Yes. What is happening here? And so again, like, the reception of this book is helping me to see even more clearly what the situation actually is.
And so I felt like a historian was the perfect person to write this book because of that. And I think you, in a way, can get away with more because this is your field, right?
Yeah, this is what we do.
This is exactly right. And also, I just want to say about Billy Graham and, you know, dancing on his grave, if you know any history about the funeral itself, his own son danced on his grave, really.
Yeah.
With heavy footsteps.
Yeah.
You know, and so... Yeah. No, I don't think you did at all.
Yeah.
But this will be eye-opening. It was eye-opening to me, super eye-opening to me. And I just that whole piece about Billy Graham. And I love, though, that you brought, we didn't even talk about the sex abuse scandals and all that. Yeah. You bring this right up to current day. Of course, yes. The book released before Ravi Zacharias.
Yeah, he was on my radar. Radar before. Okay. So I pay close attention to survivor blogs and advocates. And so I was aware of some allegations that were still really murky and not yet vetted. And so I had my eye on him. I ended up, that chapter was originally twice as long. Oh. There were so many additional stories that I just had to cut because of length.
How sad is that? Right. How deeply sad is that?
Exactly. So there was so much to grapple with. I hated researching that chapter. I hated writing it. And literally every time, you know, a book like this, you edit hundreds of times. Every time I would get to, yeah, I'm like almost done with the manuscript, next chapter, and like, no, I had to brace myself every time. It was terrible. It was terrible. And that's, you know, I like to read passages from the book and, you know, skim through it. I'm pretty happy with the book. And then that chapter, I don't even turn to. It needed to be there.
I have two final questions for you. You know, what has the book, you know, has it really matched your hopes for it or exceeded?
It's exceeded. You know, early on, I think initially I thought I can write this book and I think I can change minds because there's stuff that people need to know. And then about 2-3 months into the writing, I just gave up that hope because I thought this is so deeply entrenched. I was just overwhelmed. And I thought, this is not, and I can't change anybody's mind. This is too deeply entrenched, but I'm just going to tell the truth. It's an act of testimony. That's really what it was. And so, yes, I have been very surprised at the response to the book, both, you know, nationally and internationally. It's been featured in all kinds of, you know, countries, national news, in Japan, in China, in Germany, in Australia, in Brazil, this story is out there. And so I've been hearing from people in the global Christian community who have been deeply influenced by this culture and by these teachings, and often with devastating results. And so I hope to work in partnership with some of these folks, particularly who are working to address issues of sexual abuse in global Christian circles. And then, you know, nationally too, there, unfortunately, this book provides background to things that are in the news every week, it seems, and often, right, you know, devastating things. But the most surprising part of the reception that I did not anticipate was just how wide the embrace would be within white evangelicalism itself. I thought that there'd be some who were disaffected, who would say, thank you for this. What I didn't realize is how many people who are still deeply embedded in these systems, in these organizations, yes, in this culture, have embraced this book and have used it to clarify their own understanding and confront their own complicity. And yes, the humility with which people are reading this book is astounding. Leaders who are connecting, some are very public about it. Some are at this point still quite private about it. Down to just, you know, ordinary evangelicals of all ages in their 70s, in their 30s, and everywhere in between. And, you know, younger people, like I just spoke at a Christian college, and so many students were just incredibly enthusiastic. And their question was, how do I introduce this to my parents? Help me with that, right? How do I get my mom to read this, my dad to read this? And so, you know, really across evangelicalism, the openness to this self-critique has been really far more than I ever imagined.
Wow. Right timing. I mean, I'm glad you tabled this for a time. I mean, yeah, for sure. Right timing, yeah. You know, God knew. What's next for you? What, you know, once a book is put out there, I know, yes, authors, I know them well.
Yeah, that's exactly what my publisher asked about 5 weeks after this one released. So we do have a next project. It is a kind of the girls' version of Jesus and John Wayne. It is called Live, Laugh, Love, and it is a cultural history of white Christian womanhood, looking at things like direct sales and inspirational fiction, mommy blogs, HGTV. And it's analyzing this all in terms of post-liberalism or neoliberalism, post-feminism, and white supremacy. So again, looking at religious consumer culture as it connects to faith and politics.
I can't wait to read it. Cannot wait. Already.
It's fun. The research is crazy for this one. It is so much fun.
I believe it. And I totally believe it.
Yeah. It'll be a couple of years till it's done. Unfortunately, it takes a little time to do these things.
Well, Kristen Kobus Dume, I cannot thank you enough for taking the time and for joining me here on Faith Conversations. Jesus and John Wayne, How White Evangelicals Corrupted a Faith and Fractured a Nation. Whew. I'm still reeling from it. I might read it again. I was just, it's really powerful. Thank you for your work, and thanks for being with us here.
Oh, thank you.
And to everyone else, as always, I say, keep the conversation going.